You're listening to The Lodestar, the supply chain and logistics industry's leading source of insight. This podcast was created and produced by MK and Associates and your host, Mike King.
Well, if supply chain was a city, it would have to be New York because honestly, it really does never sleep. In this episode, we're looking at what the latest escalation of conflict in the Middle East means for freight market. We've got an update on who might be paying for the Dali tragedy at the Port of Baltimore. Flexport's Neil Jones Shah is giving us insight into company strategy and why e-commerce is driving air cargo markets. Drury's Eric Hooper is explaining how the de facto closure of the Suez Canal is impacting Mediterranean ports and shipping services. And the Lodestar's Alex Linnane is reporting from IATA's CNS Partnership Conference in Dallas-Fort Worth. She's talking fentanyl, US infrastructure failings, and why some airline executives still do not understand forwarders, in conversation with the executive director of the Air Forwarder Association. It's Brandon Freed.
The shipper comes to us with complex logistical challenges that oftentimes require many modes, not just air cargo, requires planning such as banking, regulatory adherence, and a plethora of concerns that airlines don't engage it on a routine basis. So I would say that gentleman probably had too much to drink and probably doesn't understand that forwarders manage 80% of the cargo on this aircraft, and to boot us out the door that quickly would be a lot harder for him. So serve him another drink.
Hello, everybody. I'm Mike King. Welcome to the Lodestar podcast. Housework first. You can follow this podcast wherever you like to listen. Please do review, subscribe, and anything else that supports us. Bring you independent journalism for the amazingly good value price of nothing. It's free. You can also subscribe to receive this podcast direct to your inbox, thelodestar.com, where you can also find a treasure trove of news, analysis, and updates. Let's get straight to it. Alex Linnane, Lodestar publisher, has been reporting daily from IATA's CNS Partnership Conference in Dallas-Fort Worth this week. And luckily for us, she's taking some time out to join us today. How is Texas, Alex?
It's great, Mike. I'm really enjoying it. I spent the weekend in Dallas, loved it. Not all Americans love Texas, I'm discovering, but I've really enjoyed it so far.
Excellent, excellent. Before we come on to all things air cargo, there's a couple of big shipping stories we must cover. First up is Baltimore, which we did cover on the podcast release last week, but things have been moving on rather quickly. Two main things. One, the FBI is now reportedly conducting a criminal investigation into the fatal accident which saw the 10,000 TEU class container vessel Dali, chartered by Maersk, destroy Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge in late March, killing six people. So that's something we'll be keeping an eye on. Secondly, as our own Charlotte Goldstone has reported, the vessel's owner, Singapore-based Grace Ocean, has now declared general average. Now, you can keep up to date on all this at thelodestar.com, but let me give you a quick summary. General average is one of those ancient maritime rules that people don't know much about until they get hit by a bill or find they're not insured for it. Basically, it's a maritime principle where all parties involved in a sea voyage share any losses incurred, and the share a shipper will pay correlates essentially with their share of the cargo load, if that makes sense. The ship owner, manager, and charter will also be partly liable. As Charlotte writes, the decision indicates that the owner expects the salvage operations to result in extraordinarily high costs, which will be recouped by contributions from all parties involved under general average. So what this means is all the containers on the ship will be held until ownership of each shipment, including breaking down groupage and LCL consignments, is completed. So it's quite a big process. Some cargo owners are very much going to be hoping they're covered for general average on their insurance. The Dali was on its way to China via Colombo in Sri Lanka, so we think it was mainly carrying exports, probably plenty of empties, but the liabilities could be big. Alex, is there any sort of equivalent to general average in air cargo?
Well, there's not so many ancient laws in aviation for obvious reasons, but air cargo people certainly know about insurance costs and war risk surcharges, and it's a topic that comes up pretty often when airlines do humanitarian work, and they have to pay quite a small fortune to do so. But forwarders are multimodal, so they understand general average and the language around it, yes.
Obviously, those insurance risks are increasing all the time. Which leads me nicely on to another story that does have an air cargo impact, which is the turn of events in the Middle East. In the last podcast, we reported how the Houthi rebels have expanded their zone of operations, or were threatening to expand their zone of operations. Since then, things have deteriorated. Iran has directly attacked Israel, which is a massive ramping up the conflict. Retaliation is expected. In fact, it's been promised. Iranian national forces also seized an MSC chartered vessel, the 15,000 TU Madeira flagged vessel Ares. This happened in the Straits of Hormuz on the basis of the ship's alleged links to Israel. Now, the vessel's owner is Zodiac Maritime, which, although UK-based, is controlled by Israel's Offer family, big ship owners. As Lodestar managing editor Gavin Van Maal reported, all of this raises the prospect of Iran effectively cutting off Dubai, as well as the Arabian Gulf gateway ports such as Dammam in Saudi Arabia, Qatar's Hamad port, and Iraq's Umm Qasr, all of which had recent vessel calls at the MSC Ares before it was seized by Iran. Now, Dubai has been playing a huge role in helping shippers from places such as India get to market quicker via its vast array of sea air options and role as a global freight hub. Alex, the temperature dial in the Middle East keeps going up, doesn't it? What a tragic mess it is.
Oh, Mike, it's terrible, isn't it? First of all, our thoughts are with the 25 seafarers who are now captives. I mean, everything seems to be getting a bit more dangerous. Last week, we published an International Maritime Bureau report on the increasing dangers from pirates as well. The report wrote about two hijackings by Somali pirates in Q1. Somali pirates freed the Bangladesh-flagged bulk carrier Abdullah, which was hijacked last month, indicating that the $5 million ransom had been paid. So if a ransom has been paid, there is a chance, of course, we'll see more of this. And as for Dubai, it means carriers of all types, containers, tankers, bulkers, they may have to rethink their Arabian Gulf networks. And that, of course, is going to change sea air links via Dubai, perhaps. Dubai Europe volumes were up 114% in week 14, that's according to World ACD, compared with a year ago. A lot of that's sea air volumes. So if that trade is choked up, we're going to see even more pressure on rates out of Bangladesh and India into Europe. And those were already up 150% year on year. And as we've reported on quite a bit recently, there are some bottlenecks in India.
And of course, just to complicate things further, Iran's attack on Israel and the expectation of a response has prompted carriers to cancel some service and or reroute other services to avoid Iranian airspace. For European carriers, this is getting very difficult now, given that Russian airspace has also been closed to them since 2022.
The world's getting so complicated, Mike. Yeah. So carriers rely on Iranian airspace as a vital crossing for the Asia-Europe trade. So there's concerns now that that airspace closure would create much more bottlenecks on that route. Mark Zee, founder of airspace monitoring company OPS Group, he told Reuters that carriers on the Asia-Europe trade would be restricted to two viable alternative routes, either through Turkey or via Egypt and Saudi Arabia. Air India has told the Lodestar that there will be longer routes now avoiding Iranian airspace, which will impact the trade. Air India has cancelled flights to Tel Aviv as well because of the drone attack. Carriers are now suspending flights again to Israel. Lufthansa Cargo, I think, has also suspended some flights. So, yeah, it's pretty difficult out there, Mike.
Okay, back to calmer pastures. CNS partnership. What have you been hearing from around the event, Alex?
Well, I've been conducting a little straw poll. It's not terribly accurate, I would think, but I've been trying to find out who they think is going to win the election and what the fears are around potential tariffs. You know, the devaluing of the dollar was another thing that Trump has been talking about. My straw poll shows so far that it's a very, very evenly divided country. I've got exactly the same number of people who think Trump will win as think Biden will win. A couple of don't knows, and people are very passionate about it. It's just as it was before. You either completely want one of them to win and you loathe the other, or vice versa. So there are concerns, though, from trade, obviously, about tariffs and what might happen. Someone told me that they're about to do a deal. This is an American airport, about to do a deal with a Chinese company. The Chinese won't sign until after November because they're concerned that if Trump comes in, then the game will change, frankly. So there's a bit of a wait and see thing going on in terms of trade. But yes, Americans are feeling very passionate again about the election.
And as we've covered previously on this podcast as well, this is all also playing into long-term trans-Pacific contracts, because if you're signing a one-year contract now, for example, if we do have a Trump presidency and he follows through on these tariffs, that could play into that as well quite significantly. Another old friend of this podcast is Flexport's Neil Jones Shah, who was formerly global head of air freight. Since October last year, he's had a new role as executive vice president for global key accounts and chief customer officer at Flexport. But he's now leaving the company. Is this a Linnane scoop?
I think it might be. To be honest, I haven't checked if anyone else has got it, but I suspect it is. Yeah, he's off from August, I believe. They're going through a transition period right now so that someone else can come in. He was saying he wants the transition to be nice and smooth. So yes, yet another person leaving Flexport seems to happen quite often.
Did Neil mention what he's doing next?
He said that he's about to be 55, I think, and so he feels like he's got one more job left in him, so he's going to go and do something he really is passionate about. He hasn't told me what. He said there's still a few more details for him to go through, but I think he's going to announce probably in a couple of weeks where he's off to.
Neil, come and announce it on here. You're welcome anytime, my friend. As you mentioned there, Flexport has seen quite a lot of management changes, including losing a whole bunch of former Amazon executives led by former CEO Dave Clark, who controversially was ousted by Flexport founder Ryan Peterson last year. Since then, we've seen a series of quite brutal staff cuts. What did Neil say about that?
Well, one of the things I like talking to Neil is that he's always as honest as he can be. And he didn't hold back. He acknowledged that that's what's been happening at Flexport. He pointed out that their cost structure has just simply been too high and it needed dealing with. I mean, that's come on top of what every forwarder's facing at the moment. You know, it's been difficult. So I asked Neil if this was the end of the restructuring at Flexport.
I would say so. I mean, it's hard for anybody to sit here and say, oh, it's never going to happen again. It would be absolutely silly for me to ever sit here and say that. But I think for the time being, I would say absolutely yes. The company, again, is just focused on growth. And I'm sure there are areas where they're looking to even shore up, right? You know, where they need specific talents and things like that. So to continue to allow the business to grow and flourish. And I think Flexport's best chapters are ahead of it. I'm very bullish on the company's prospects. I really am. I really, really believe in the vision of what we're trying to accomplish. And I think the company is going to get there in short order. So,
is it going to be profitable? Ryan said it was going to be profitable by the end of the year, I think he said.
Yeah, I mean, I'll let you ask Ryan that. So that's a question for him to answer. What I will just say is that a lot of progress has been made towards that goal. So I will leave it at that. But if you want to ask Ryan or Stu, who's our CFO, that specific question, I think that's fair game. And you should ask him. He may choose not to answer, but you should definitely ask him. But I think, you know, like I said, a lot of progress has been made. And definitely the trajectory is 100% pointing in the right direction.
Prior to joining Flexport, Dave Clark had previously spent 23 years at Amazon, most notably building up its huge logistic network, and he was handpicked to take over as Flexport CEO by Peterson. He was also the man who was credited with the purchase of Deliver from Shopify. But Peterson was pretty critical of some of his other decisions. Let's have a listen to part of that conversation you had with Neil about Deliver and about the loss of Clark.
Yeah, I mean, look, we're doing a lot of work right now to rationalize the deliverer fulfillment network and change the way sort of that operates rather than 35 warehouses using 5 mega warehouses, right? So inventory doesn't get split between warehouses and things like that. And so there's a lot of work that's going into that. I'm not the expert on that at all. So I think it would be unfair for me to comment any further. But again, there's a really good team that's putting, you know, 7 days a week work against sort of hitting some very important milestones with all of that work. And it's all going, I believe I'm not as up to versa, you know, really according to plan. So it's moving along. And so the goal is to make that business be standalone profitable. It needs to be.
And in terms of the sort of culture of Flexport with the Amazon, Dave Clark and all of that, when everyone left, did it feel very different? Did it feel like, oh, right, we're back to who we are again now? Or did it feel like, we missed these guys and that was a nice drive that they had?
No, certainly not the latter. Okay. I wouldn't say it was the latter at all. Post Dave leaving, right, there's still been a lot of work that's needed to happen, right? Mm-hmm. And we all know there was the reduction in force in October, again on February 1. So I think those are big traumatic events for companies. You can't sugarcoat this in any way. They're big events and you hate doing them. But sometimes they're very necessary because you have to change the course of where you're headed. Sometimes you can't do that with real incremental movements of the rudder. You just can't do it, right? I mean, you have to make bigger, bolder moves. And so that's what happened. And as I said, I think it's had the desired impact and outcome. I think overall, we're getting back to what Flexport stood for and the energy and all that was there, right? I remember the early days because I was around, right? And it was just, it was an energy. There was an energy, it was palpable.
We've covered on this podcast previously how e-commerce this year has really been driving those air freight markets. What did Neil say about this, Alex?
Yeah, e-commerce is of course driving the market. All the airlines I've spoken to have agreed that that's the case. Oh, actually, Mike, there's a little exclusive for you on the podcast. Flexport has got a second plane coming out in livery, I think, shortly. I don't know if you've ever sort of looked on LinkedIn about Flexport's liveried planes, but it often amuses the market. But companies that have their own livery planes do get very excited about it. So yeah, another plane in Flexport livery coming out soon. And Neil was saying that the planes are full. There was a worry probably a year or so ago that Flexport was really struggling to fill its trans-Pacific flights. And they did a deal with WestJet, in fact, to try and help fill the flights. But he says they're now really full. It's not just e-commerce. They've got consumer electronics, they've got industrial, they've got automotive. But yeah, e-commerce is the main driver at the moment.
Two Linane scoops in one podcast. Okay, fantastic. Let's have a little listen to what Neil thinks about the e-commerce market at the moment. It's quite interesting stuff.
You know, the e-commerce guys are now the biggest buyers of air freight that exists right now, right? I mean, when you look at the Shein, Temu, Cainiao, AliExpress, all of these companies, they're just buying massive quantities of air freight, and they're buying it from a variety of sources. They're very smart procurers. These guys didn't fall off a turnip truck yesterday. They know how to purchase capacity, but they also know that this capacity is absolutely vital to their strategy, right? If they can't fulfill in the time period that they've committed to the customer, then their business model comes into question. And so they are procuring capacity in a variety of different ways. A lot of them are going direct to the carriers, and direct to the asset owners and doing big deals. They're also buying a significant amount of capacity from freight forwarders who have gone to the airlines and done big deals. So I would say across the board, international e-commerce fulfillment is probably 40 to 50% of every kilo of air freight out of Asia this year. It's a big number. This number might have been less than 10% 5 years ago, just because nobody had heard of these guys. They didn't really exist 5-6 years ago, right? And so now they're procuring a lot of capacity. They are really concerned about their own growth. Their own growth depends on their access to capacity. So that's more important to them than, let's say, securing the absolute sharpest rate. So they're more interested in fueling their growth. And I think airlines have not been shy about talking about the fact that they think the e-commerce guys are better customers, right? They're easier to deal with from many perspectives. We also work very closely with the largest e-commerce players, and they have been phenomenal to work with. They're great customers of ours. We'll do a heck of a lot more with them this year than we did last year. So the growth is definitely there, and we're excited to partner with them. But, you know, just don't want to be a one-trick pony for them either. And just so there's a lot of services that these guys can and do need.
Neil is always really insightful, isn't he, Alex? Just moving on, what else was going on at CNS?
Yeah, it's been pretty interesting. Mostly I've been chatting with people rather than listening a lot to, you know, digitalization streams or whatever. But there was a good one on women in cargo. Last year, they did one on women in cargo, and I have to say, I walked away from it quite irate because they talked about how women manage work-life balance, but they didn't ask any men that, so it was quite annoying. But this year, Cathay Cargo ran it, and it was excellent. You came away feeling really positive about it. It wasn't just about gender diversity in the workplace, it was all diversity. And it was a really positive session. I can't remember coming away from any panel in a conference that's sort of positive about things. And you've got to take your hats off to Cathay Cargo, who really know what they're talking about. They explained about blinding CVs and and really how you get away from unconscious bias, what you can do to support diversity in the workplace. It was really good. It was a bit of a contrast to, unfortunately, something that Brandon Fried said earlier, which was a bit more depressing, but I'll leave you to talk about that for a bit.
Okay, yeah, we'll bring in Brandon now. He's the executive director of the Air Forward Association. I know you had a chat to him. We'll hear what he says about the fentanyl problem, but just some background. It really is a mass killer. It's a synthetic opioid, 50 times more powerful than heroin. Over 100,000 people in the US are currently dying each year due to fentanyl overdoses. You know, in the Vietnam War, 60,000 US military personnel lost their lives. In World War II, it was estimated over 400,000 people lost their lives. That's the context that you're looking at. Now, US legislators are looking at the logistics industry as a way of slowing the supply of fentanyl imports or the inputs that you need to make fentanyl. They're trying to slow those down too. Let's hear what Brandon says about this.
Fentanyl and illicit fentanyl-type drugs accounted for over 100,000 U.S. deaths last year. And putting that into perspective, less than 3,000 were killed in the World Trade Center attacks on September 11th. So the U.S. really needs to start focusing on this issue. In our engagement on Capitol Hill, the Senate offices that we've been talking to are asking us about this. And now the White House is looking at intermediaries, freight forwarders and others, as possible tools in the fight against illicit fentanyl traffic coming into the U.S. But it's not just the fentanyl itself, it's the precursors. It's the pill presses. It's the chemicals shipped individually that are joined up here in the United States to comprise the actual drug itself. So what we've said to the White House, we've said to Capitol Hill is, we're here to help. We understand that. But as freight forwarders, most of the time we're dealing with data. We're relying on what's been told to us is in the packages. And we are, in fact, screening for explosives, primarily through canine, but other methods as well. And what we're saying to lawmakers is we need to start investing in those technologies to train the dogs, to allow for technology to detect these illicit substances. Any notion of 100% physical inspection of every single package is a non-starter to us. That would impede the flow of commerce, and it really rewards the bad guys. And certainly, fentanyl is not the majority of shipments coming across. And so there are many Senate offices that feel that the cause of the fentanyl scourge is because we increased the de minimis and Customs and Border Protection can't possibly look at every single package. But if you talk to a lot of forwarders that are involved in e-commerce transactions, they'll tell you that's not the case. Those chemicals are coming in through other ways. They're coming in on trucks. They're coming in, they're being smuggled, that type of thing. So it's a multifaceted issue. To look to the intermediary as the solution, I think is just not workable.
So Alex, what does Brandon think is a better solution?
Well, there's a few things that can be done, one of which is dogs. You know, sniffer dogs are widely used in the US for explosive detection, but they're expensive to train. You can't use the same dogs for drugs that you can for explosives. And one of the issues is that, you know, fentanyl comes in different parts, is bought in and it's different chemical makeups. And you can be killed just by breathing it in, apparently. So that's not great for the dogs. That's a big problem. And it could lead to sort of more airport congestion as well. So he said that education and training would be a key way to help prevent this. You know, red flags. If you have a new shipper who's been a bit vague about what they're shipping in, tell someone about it. He was very much in the see something and say something if it doesn't seem right to you. It's not 100% effective, but it's sort of the best that can be done at the moment, I think.
You also asked him about the Dali incident in Baltimore and what it says about infrastructure investment in the US. Let's hear what he said, because it's pretty damning.
So my position on that is that the Tampa Sunshine Skyway Bridge was hit by a ship and killed 35 people in 1985. The United States, unfortunately, doesn't make substantial infrastructure investments unless it counts a sufficient amount of headstones to spark investment. If we look at the Baltimore Key Bridge, we need to ask ourselves why those towers weren't protected. with a system that would at least slow down a ship careening toward the towers. Ships are going to run out of power, whatever the investigation yields. It could be bad power, it could be bad fuel, it could be anything. Maybe, for all we know, that the pilot fell asleep at the wheel. I don't know, but they're going to hit bridges. Bridges are stationary. It's indicative, and I think it correlates to what we're seeing at the airport with these cargo areas lacking sufficient infrastructure investment. We saw it in the most recent infrastructure bill that was passed 2 years ago, where the airports asked for $115 billion in assistance. They got $25 billion. It's not going to the cargo areas. Meanwhile, our trucks are still waiting for two and a half hours. Now, the White House has responded to the Department of Transportation to us, and they've said, well, you know, the Airport Improvement Fund is in fact making investments, and they elaborated on two or three investments that had some nexus to cargo. Well, my response to that is, but the trucks are still waiting in line 2.5 hours. So what are you talking about? There's a lot more work to be done. And we have to call attention to this because 50% of the cargo is running in the bellies of these passenger airplanes. Let's get something done. And by the way, it's not just here in the US, it's other countries as well.
And finally, Alex, what's this about carriers versus forwarders or carriers not needing forwarders? Is that right?
Yeah, this is one of my favorite chats, to be honest. It was over a beer in the evening. But one carrier, and I haven't heard this for a very long time, said, we don't need forwarders. They suck all the money out of the business. The asset owners should be making the money, not the people in between. I mean, it was a fairly heated debate between everyone who was standing there. And I really haven't heard an airline say that for a long time. I did say, will you go on the record to talk about this? And he immediately backtracked. So I'm not sure how much he was prepared to put his money where his mouth is. But I think that the general gist of it was that forwarders keep taking money away from the asset owners and he doesn't feel that they add value. Well, I put that to Brandon and, you can hear what he says now.
It's certainly an antiquated and I would say myopic perspective. The reality is that airlines do what they do best, and that's transporting boxes from one city to another, and they do it well. But the reality is that the shipper comes to us with complex logistical challenges that oftentimes require many modes, not just air cargo, requires planning such as banking, regulatory adherence, and a plethora of concerns that airlines don't engage in on a routine basis. So I would say that gentleman probably had too much to drink and probably doesn't understand that forwarders manage 80% of the cargo on his aircraft, and to boot us out the door that quickly would be a lot harder for him. So serve him another drink.
Alex, I'm sure we'll be seeing your stories from the conference appearing on theLoadStar.com in the coming days. Any hints on what else you might be covering or conversations you'll be having and reporting?
Well, there was chat at IATA in Hong Kong in March that this may be the last CNS. So the head of CNS, Laura Pullens, has left. Apparently she was overwhelmed by the different amount of things that she was being asked to do. And so there was chat that CNS might end. Now, CNS, of course, is the IATA's US subsidiary and is also related to the CAS settlement system, payment system, of which there are some rival ones starting up. So there's a slight sense of what, you know, is there any point to CAS? Is there any point to CNS? But really what CNS partnership is about is it's carrier and forwarder meetings, a bit like a tiny TPM, to be honest. So all day, the carriers and forwarders are talking with each other about 2025 capacities, volumes and rates, although obviously the rates can be renegotiated because it'd be a brave person to negotiate a rate for 2025 right now. And it's very busy here, actually. There's about 700 people. So, and people seem to really enjoy it. So I don't believe it is the end of the CNS partnership event at all. I think there'll be several more to come.
We'll be hearing from Eric Cooper, Senior Analyst for Ports and Terminals at Drury in a moment. But for now, Alex Linnane, Loadstar Publisher, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Mike.
Okay, guys, this is an interview I did with Eric Cooper, who's Senior Analyst for Ports and Terminals at Drury. Eric has 2 decades of experience in ports, including lengthy stints with the likes of DP World and P&O Ports. We spoke in the first week of April about some of the little covered impacts of Suez container shipping diversions. This was before Iran attacked Israel with drones and seized the ship in the Iranian Gulf, as we were discussing earlier. But the key points are still valid. I started by asking him how the Red Sea crisis was affecting transit times to Mediterranean ports.
The short answer is not great. Prior to the Red Sea crisis, the Med was served both by dedicated Asian Med loops, but also by the Asia North Europe strings, which could use the East or Central Med hubs like Damietta or Piraeus without significant deviation. So they could drop off all of the Mediterranean-based cargo there before carrying on to North Europe. So using the Suez meant a transit from Shanghai to Piraeus, for example, of about 22 days. With Shanghai to Rotterdam, the transit would be about 30 days. So diverting around the Cape has added in the region of 10 to 12 days for the Asia to North Europe loops for those port pairs. But transit for the East Med has been extended beyond that because obviously they're not wake hauling on their way. So Ocean Alliance recently released their day eight products, stressing reliability. The details are still yet to be announced, even though they're starting this month. But they have services that call kind of last port in Asia is Singapore. First port in the Med is Piraeus. But presumably that would be a lot longer than the 22 days that they previously used to have.
And would that be the normal sort of strategy for the East Med then, even now with the closure of the Suez, that you would go far east and then come back out again? Is that how it works?
No, I mean, I was a bit surprised when I saw their loops structured that way. Our assumption had been that most of the Mediterranean cargo would actually have been centered around the West Med hubs, whether Tanger Med or Valencia or Algeciras, and then having dedicated Mediterranean loops taking the cargo from the West Med further east.
And as the Ocean Alliance, is that strategy that they're taking then with more direct calls? Is that what we're seeing from the other guys, the other alliances?
I think a lot of the services are still in a state of flux whilst they're working out how long the Red Sea crisis will survive, and also what the best strategy is to serving those markets.
Just looking at those ports in the Med, you guys put out a good report on this, and looking at winners and losers to a degree, and it shows that while some ports have not really been affected so much, such as Algeciras, Piraeus saw volumes down 13% in January, and Valencia and Barcelona increased 11%. Is this an ongoing pattern that you're expecting?
Yeah, and I think this comes back to my earlier point about how the lines are structuring their services. So we would expect the West Med hubs, whether it's Algeciras, Valencia, Tanger Med, we'd expect those to handle higher volumes of transshipment cargo for the whole of the Mediterranean, North African, and even Northern Red Sea market. Whereas the East Med hubs like Piraeus, we'd expect to see less volumes, specifically because they're losing their transshipment volumes that they used to handle.
We've done a fair bit on Sea Air Solutions, which have taken off as a result of this Red Sea crisis, closure of the Suez. Two of the airports that have done particularly well is obviously Dubai. But Colombo in Sri Lanka has also fared rather well. Are you seeing any sort of change in volumes at Colombo's terminals down in Sri Lanka or any other ports down there? Obviously, there's Habanatotem, which I've actually went to not that long ago, but can't pronounce it very well.
So, yes, as the first major port east of the Red Sea for any vessels diverting via the Cape, Colombo is emerging as a key transshipment hub. So it offers carriers the opportunity to transship cargo between those services which divert via the Cape and the services to and from the Middle East. So we see throughput increasing 30% year to date at end Feb. We've also seen Colombo added as a new call on a number of Asia-Europe loops, MSC's Dragon service, the Alliance's FE4, ZIM's ZFP services, and MSC has also added a Colombo call to a bunch of its other services, South Asia, Asia, West Coast, North America, the Sentosa Shikra. We've got the IPAC service as well, which has added the Indus service, and the Ocean Alliance, I think, included Colombo as a new port call in a number of its services. So we see this as a trend that will continue in the coming weeks and months, yeah.
Eric Hooper, thanks for joining me today on the Lodestar podcast.
Mike, thank you very much indeed.
Big thanks to my editing team, Karen Ball and Tom Matthews. And most of all, gratitude to you all for listening. We'll be back soon.